Welcome to Spotlight Africa, broadcast from Channel Africa, the home of news and views presented from an African perspective, coming away from Johannesburg, South Africa. But this program will showcase and highlight African countries and issues of the African continent and its people. Today, in the light of South Africa assuming the chair of the African Union, we present a program that looks at and interrogates the priorities, agenda, and strategy of the African Union, namely the implementation of African Free Trade Arrangement and the long-term Agenda 63 Development Program. I'm Issa Homo, the producer and presenter. Stay tuned. On the 9th January 2020, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa assumed the chairmanship of the African Union. In his acceptance speech, President Ramaphosa laid out a vision for Africa. This basically encompassed in priorities and strategy to implement some of the pressing issues that confront the African continent, the African countries, and basically the aspirations of its people, who presently number 1 billion African citizens. Africa is a continent that is endowed in resources, these being natural resources and also mineral resources. However, Africa is the least developed continent, this generally meaning that the African people are the least developed people in the world. The African Union Agenda 63 is the blueprint and master plan for transforming Africa into the global powerhouse of the future. It is a strategic framework for delivering Africa's goal for inclusive and sustainable development. The agenda also proposes to promote Africa's growth and economic development by championing citizens' inclusion and increased cooperation and integration of African states. The agenda identified key program areas, these being, amongst others, conflict resolution, peace and security, infrastructure and development, agricultural development, trade and industrial development. However, key to Africa's development goals has been the formation of the African Continental Free Trade Area, a free trade area that will be the world's biggest free trade zone. And it is envisaged that it will be a catalyst to the establishment of an African manufacturing sector. I engaged Dr. Pilani Mtembo, the Executive Director of the Institute for Global Dialogue, a foreign policy think tank, on issues, priorities, and challenges that face the African continent and strategies towards attaining the Agenda 63. Dr. Pilani, right now we find that South Africa has actually assumed the chair of the AU. And our President Ramaphosa has talked a lot about achieving the aims and the agendas of the AU. But first, let's just talk about the AU's goals and challenges. What can you tell us about that?
One of the key challenges for the AU has been actually advancing a much more coordinated approach when it comes to Africa's international relations. We know that there's a lot of interest in the past couple of years when it comes to engaging on the continent. So we see a whole range of actors wanting to have, you know, or at least having some sort of Africa strategy, having some kind of an Africa platform or fora where they meet every few years. But I think, as you see, that there's a growing interest on the African continent from external actors, a key challenge has been, how do you coordinate Africa's engagement at a bilateral, sub-regional, and continental level? And I think that's been an issue that's been confronting, I think, the African Union and also just its own agency, you know, enhancing its own agency, making sure that it's also actually mobilizing resources for its operations domestically, rather than being dependent on donor funding. So these are some of the challenges that have obviously been confronting the AU. You know, you think about issues of peace and security, and if you think about agency, that a lot of the operations on the continent, you know, rely on funding from external players. And that obviously has implications in terms of the continent's ability to actually solve some of the issues and to apply, you know, material resources into that. And, you know, those are some of the challenges I think that the Ramaphosa administration confronts, you know, as it sits on as a chair of the African Union. But there is a framework, you know, I mean, there's a framework, Agenda 2063. So I think even though South Africa is chairing, I think it's important to understand that the position has limitations. It's not an executive position. So South Africa can't just obviously dictate what should be the agenda. Rather, it seeks to, yes, amplify certain issues, but also stay within the framework of the decisions that have been taken prior to South Africa's chairship of the AU.
Let's go back to the top of the issues that you talked about. You talked about the African strategy, and Africa has got a challenge of not having a unified African strategy. We all know that, and we tend to say that the African strategy, once they've tried to put it together, the unity just breaks out because the strategy which comes there, it could either be a Franco-Afrique strategy from France or something else. And now there are also new players in the African situation. Those are the GCC countries, the Gulf countries. They're playing a very big part within the African scenario. But then tell us about this danger of the external actors, as you call them, who are actually coming to be able to influence African countries and also sabotage the African unity. I'm talking about the GCC countries with their interest in the Horn of Africa, again, their interest in the Red Sea region, and also the interests within the North African belt, talk about Libya, and also in the Nile Valley, Sudan. Tell us something about these challenges that Africa has faced.
Yes, well, I think, you know, in one way, it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity, because I think clearly what countries outside of the continent understand is they understand the geostrategic importance of the continent. They also understand the trends that are taking place on the continent, whether it's demographically, also technologically. And they understand that in the coming decades, the continent presents a huge opportunity, you know, for them, both in terms of partnering on various initiatives in multilateral fora, but also as a potential market, you know, for their products, both goods and services. So they see massive opportunities. They see a young continent, a continent that is going to double in its population size. So they're looking at that, and they are seeing opportunities on the continent for their various interests. Now, one cannot, I mean, taking into account how global politics operate, one cannot fault external powers for having an interest or taking an interest in the continent. But I think the challenge for the continent is to see how can it cohesively use its engagement with external actors towards meeting its own developmental needs. Now, the continent is massive in size, at least, and in diversity. But there are institutions and structures that should be at least playing a greater role in coordinating the efforts of the continent. And when we see, I mean, whether it's either the great powers, your U.S., right now major discussions are happening with what the U.S. is going to be doing post-AGOA, for instance, which is going to run out and expire in 2025. you know, there's already talk about whether the U.S. will be wanting to negotiate bilateral agreements with African countries, what impact that might have on the African Continental Free Trade Area. But we see that the current administration prefers bilateral negotiations to multilateral. And so that's going to have an impact. But there's also other players, you know, whether it's Europe. Europe has been busy with your economic partnership agreements on the continent and also trying to shape a certain trade landscape with your African, Caribbean and Pacific countries. So that's also, you know, a challenge that the continent is facing. And again, implications of how those trade negotiations impact the cohesiveness and the goals of regional integration. But at the same time, you know, you've got also countries from the global south, whether it's China, whether it's India, who are increasing also and have been increasing their trade relations and just their political and social relations with the continent. We see Russia again re-engaging the continent through the Russia-Africa summit that was hosted last year. So we see a whole range of actors. We go to the Horn and to your Sahel and moving further up north, you see the dynamics between your Gulf countries and African countries, which, you know, also tend to then get sucked in into the geopolitics of the Middle East. So, you know, you see what's happening in Libya and how the major players who are involved in the post-Libya discussions are essentially your external players. And, you know, so that's why when we talk, we at least when we do certain work on African agency, we refer to the importance of having something, not just national sovereignty, but working towards what you might call a continental sovereignty, or that the continent needs to have strategic autonomy over its international relations. Now, that doesn't mean disengaging with the world. Instead, it means that aligning the relations that we have with external players as a catalyst to meeting our regional goals, our sub-regional goals and our national goals. So it doesn't also mean that countries cannot engage bilaterally with other countries. But I think it's important that when you talk about these various Africa platforms and Africa fora, where various countries, whether it's China, India, Japan, EU, United States, Turkey, South Korea, all of these countries have various Africa fora and Africa platforms. It's important that increasingly that African countries coordinate their positions more and ensure that those international engagements are actually channeled towards meeting the continent's agreed to strategic objectives. And some of those strategic objectives, you know, are there in things like Agenda 2063, but there's also other, you know, your sub-regional groupings also have agreed to regional infrastructure projects that they see as catalysts. So it's important, I think, in looking at the growing interest from external actors in Africa, that African countries understand that they are increasing their material and their strategic and negotiation position by coordinating together. And that means that even the larger powers in the sub-regional blocs need to align their individual positions towards the goals of the sub-region. It means that also then that at the sub-regional level, then it has to be a closer coordination with the African Union. So that even when we talk about, you know, Agenda 2063, and we understand that there's 12 so-called catalyst or flagship projects that the continent has agreed to, then we can use those various international fora to actually channel the resources of external actors towards supporting those, because we see that those projects will have a catalytic impact on regional integration, on African agency, and so forth. So it's about using those relations strategically rather than blaming external powers for having national interest, or at least in trying to secure their national interest in their relations with the continent.
But then in Africa, as you rightly pointed out, we find that the most critical body for African unity or for implementing the African agenda, it's basically the regional and the sub-regional bodies. Now, we talk about these regional or sub-regional bodies, they've got to have their own goals, their own priorities, and their own projects, and things like SADC, things like the Central African economic thing, the things like the East African common market, the North African, it is there, but it's not doing very well. You've got also ECOWAS, which is the most successful. But then we find that it's at this point, at that level, that the whole thing actually fails. The regional bodies, once they agree on something, they cannot implement it, or it is actually being captured by, as you call them, external players, and we tend to lose the focus. Now, tell us about these challenges of these regional bodies and really what needs to happen to governments, because for these regional plans to be successful, they've got to be adopted into the national planning stage and into the national fiscus. But now tell us about the challenges that Africa is facing from these regional bodies not being able to implement what they set out to do.
And I think one of the major challenges that inhibits the agency of these regional organizations is that they're still overly dependent on external actors. You know, just their budgets. You know, you go through their budgets and you see to the extent to which they are dependent on external actors, donors in the United States, donors in Europe. And you see that if you are serious about having well-functioning pan-African institutions, it's going to increasingly be important that those institutions are actually funded by African stakeholders. And that means both state actors and non-state actors, you know, in private sector and so forth. So the whole idea of domestic resource mobilization is absolutely important. If African countries are serious about, you know, moving ahead with the so-called African agenda, they need to also put their money, you know, where their mouths are. But they need to also show commitment and ensure that the fees in these regional bodies are paid up on time and that they are paid up consistently, and that increasingly the resources that go into funding these organizations are actually African resources. You know, we've seen where continental bodies face an uphill when there is a clash, for instance, with the interests of stronger and more coherent actors. I mean, we saw, for instance, in Libya, where there was a process where the AU was moving toward what they called African solutions to African problems, negotiating with the former leader of Libya, Gaddafi. In fact, they had even agreed to a transition period and so forth. But they couldn't enforce their own plan because stronger actors were being involved, actors who had resources on the ground. And we saw that, you know, they weren't able to then mediate and are also largely being left out of the post-Libya negotiation. And that just tells you that ultimately, no matter how good your aims and your goals are, if you don't have the material capabilities and if you don't have the resources to actually implement, you know, the goals that you set out, then you'll always be found wanting. And stronger actors, more organized actors will essentially take advantage. And that's, I think, the challenge of these regional bodies, to ensure that they're mobilizing resources increasingly domestically, and they own their agenda also. But it doesn't exempt, for instance, the international community. So, for instance, in issues such as peace and security, there have been arguments, again, at the UN Security Council that there should be consistent funding, you know, for peacekeeping operations in Africa. And that's been, you know, a contentious issue consistently. So it doesn't mean that just because you're mobilizing resources domestically, you're now exonerating the international community from their responsibility. So I think it's a two-pronged approach, boosting capacity within, but still holding the international community accountable for the commitment that they themselves have actually made towards peace and security, towards development, and towards other goals. And I think that's the challenge for some of these regional economic communities. And I think sometimes, you know, the way we discuss them, it's not just about pooling sovereignty on all issues, but I think there are certain issues that they can agree that it works to their strategic advantage when they pool sovereignty in those areas. You know, if the U.S., as it is doing now, if it's in talks with Kenya to have a free trade agreement, there's pros and cons to either Kenya going at it alone or Kenya negotiating a free trade agreement with the East African community or negotiating under, you know, terms drawn up by the African Continental Free Trade Area. So I think we need to strategically pool sovereignty on certain issues. And last year you did have a coordination meeting between the African Union and the regional economic community. And that was the first of its kind. And I think if such can continue, then you have stronger coordination between the regional economic community and the African Union, which has not always been there.
Now, sticking to the issue of the regional bodies and the budget and also the consistent funding, not from the donors, but from within. Now, there have been talk among certain people when they look at the African regional bodies and also the African bodies in saying that Africa, basically, it is a continent or there are countries which basically are resource-based, their economies, their resource-based. And that's an artificial situation because the economies basically are not diversified and they're susceptible to vagaries of the international commodity markets. But then these same people, they say that Africa has actually got to sit down and look at the world market, and that being resource owners, they've got to actually come in and take over the whole the value chain of their resources. And what they're really talking about is that they're talking about Africa having cartels around their minerals. They're talking about if it's an oil company, why shouldn't there be an eighth sister? There are seven sisters now, the big multinational oil companies. But why shouldn't Africa come up with a single oil exploration, oil production, and oil marketing organ that's going to market African oils, and they're going to market it at rates at which they know which is best for African countries? If they cannot sell it on the world market, they should sell it within. It will save the foreign exchange that they've got. They're also talking about other minerals like iron ore. Guinea's got your huge reserves which are taken over by the French and the Australians. They're fighting over it. Now, what they're talking about, there be Pan-African conglomerates, which are basically cartels. And I think that is one way in which these cartels, be they regional or continental, could actually come up, have the earnings, and also finance the AU and also finance the African programs. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, there's two things. So on the one side, I think we can do a much better job as countries and regions in terms of compelling and incentivizing your existing multinationals to rather manufacture in our countries and regions instead of actually just shipping you know, raw materials outside of our countries and then reselling them back to us. So that's on the one side. So it means existing large firms, you know, that are involved in extractive industries, we need to find ways of ensuring that we make sure that they're beneficiating some of the goods that they are extracting in those particular places, also as part of their long-term strategies, because the market in years to come is increasingly going to be here on the African continent. So if foreign companies are manufacturing in Africa, they can actually reduce their costs and reach their market much faster. You also have a large pool of young workers, you know, who are ready, for instance, to take up jobs in some of those manufacturing sectors. So there is an opportunity to attract more manufacturing on the continent. But also, to the point you're mentioning, there's also an opportunity, I think, for African industrialists to seize the opportunities that are clearly visible on the continent. Because on the one side, you've already got the likes of Dangote, who are expanding, you know, their kind of business empires and moving increasingly to various parts of the continent and investing in your refinery in Nigeria. And you've also got other industrialists on the continent. And I think our approach can't just be government-led. I think it's in the interest of African business people to actually be the first movers when it comes to the trends that we're seeing on the continent. Because otherwise, I mean, if they're not the first movers, then others will actually fill the vacuum. You'll have then industrialists from Asia, from Europe, and other places coming to the continent and taking those opportunities. So I think it is important, you know, that while you have, you know, the biggest free trade area in the world that's, you know, being created with the African Continental Free Trade Area, I think it's also important that you ensure that the conditions and the more technical conditions that you put enable African businesses to also thrive within that African Continental Free Trade Area. And that's going to be the responsibility not only for government, but also for the private sector on the continent.
Now, talking about the African Free Trade Area, as you mentioned earlier, that there is a danger of it being taken over by outside players, where they are going to take advantage of the world's biggest free trade area. And they would actually sort of, through bilateral agreements, come in and hive off a lot of things which will be basically not African. But I think, could you actually tell us about the possible dangers and challenges that an African free trade area actually is exposed to, and what should be done to actually protect and make this free trade area really African, it benefit Africans, and also it be a market for, or it be an environment for African manufacturers. I'm not talking about state manufacturers, I'm talking about the private manufacturers to come and actually dominate and actually come up. Because whether we like it or not, the African conglomerates are needed, and this will be the real saviors of Africa.
Right now, you've got discussions between the US and Kenya, for instance, around having a free trade area. Now, some are saying that, no, Kenya should rather wait until we finalize the details around the Continental Free Trade Area. And, you know, some are obviously of a different opinion. So, you know, we're already entering kind of that landscape where global actors obviously understand that it is in their interest to get involved in the African Continental Free Trade Area. And of course, one of the things that they have been complaining about in previous years is how difficult it is to trade within the continent, the time they spend at the borders, you know, increasing their costs, So it obviously is an attractive initiative for large international players when you actually create a single market on the continent. But I think the continental free trade area, being an African market, also has to obviously take into account the particular conditions on the continent. I mean, we are talking about a continent which is home to the largest number of least developed countries in the world. Now, if we're home to the largest number of least developed countries, it means that the free trade area needs to take cognizance of the various stages of development that different African countries find themselves in, and the types of commitments they take in opening their market, you know, also need to take that into account. So it's going to be a complicated, I think, discussion around your more technical elements within the free trade area. Because on the one side, you want to protect African light industries and allow them to be able to grow. But at the same time, you want to attract foreign investors to not just invest in extracting resources, but to also invest in making products on the continent. So it means that even the rules of origin need to be well considered, in a sense that they don't constrain African manufacturers from sourcing products in the international market, but that they also don't make it easy for multinational corporations to simply take products that are not made in Africa and put a label made in Africa and then sell it within the market. You know, so those are some of the balancing acts that are going to have to obviously be negotiated. And that's going to be, I think, one of the top issues on the priority agenda for the South Africa's chairship of the AU. And, I mean, we'll have to see, I think, mid-year how those discussions around the rules of origin are actually faring and what kind of exemptions are provided to least developed countries in Africa, but also what type of commitments your larger African economies are going to take up. Because the larger economies are also going to have to take leadership and actually demonstrate that they are willing, you know, to open up certain sectors to other African players. You know, one of the big challenges is that sometimes you find that countries in Africa have less trade barriers with countries in Europe, with the US and external actors than they have even amongst each other. And I think that's one of the areas that will obviously have to be looked at, so that we're not all trying to produce the same products, you know, but that our industrialization strategies also take into account the creation of regional value chains within the continent.
Let's go to another topic, which is really at the center of the AU. And I'm talking about this issue of silencing the guns in 2020. But basically, silencing the guns in 2020, okay, we won't be able to meet the deadline. But just the issue of silencing the gun without putting it in a particular time frame, what is holding back Africa in silencing the guns?
Well, the thing is, you have progress on certain issues, but then you also have relapsing conflicts in other parts of the continent. So I think there have been, I mean, if you just look at Southern Africa, of course, there's issues also. But you take into account, for instance, that 25, 30 years ago, you had a belligerent South African state causing havoc within the region in military terms. And if you take into account, I think, a longer time frame, and you see that some of those conflicts are becoming less pronounced, but you still do have the problem of, you know, your post-conflict scenarios. You also have, you know, bad cases such as Libya, a country which was essentially had one of the highest, if not the highest, living standards on the continent before the war in Libya. and that obviously takes the continent far back, you know, to have such a country falling into civil war. And you have newer conflicts, obviously, that are emerging. But I think, largely speaking, a lot of the conflicts in Africa, rather than being interstate conflicts, you know, they still largely remain intra-state conflicts, of course, with certain state and non-state actors involved in fueling them. But I think that characteristic on the continent creates a good condition for the creation and operationalization of these Africa standby forces, which essentially, it's not about each state arming itself, but it's more about the principle of collective security. So there is an opportunity, I think, in putting more resources into our collective security. But again, you know, the challenge is, to what extent are African countries willing to put, you know, those resources and to put the political will that is required to actually have those types of standby forces ready to prevent any types of conflicts, to have those early warning systems moving. You know, a key issue is also just the state capacity across the continent. We speak about sovereignty, but there's very few countries that are actually sovereign, that actually are able to exercise sovereignty over their territorial and maritime space. And, you know, those weak state institutions, they also create vacuums and also fuel conflicts from time to time. Because when you've got those weak, you know, states, and they're not actually able to actually govern over their entire territory, you create pockets and vacuums where non-state actors and larger state actors also are able to exploit, you know, those spaces for their own benefit, whether it's through exploiting mineral resources or just installing essentially friendly governments and protecting them, irrespective of their record. Those are some of the challenges that confront the continent. So that's why the continent needs to focus more on issues around enhancing Africa's agency, but also enhancing our state and non-state institutions so that you have, you know, much more coherent states rather than weak states that are easily exploited by various actors, both local and international. So that hinders, you know, the whole idea of silencing the guns, because when you're confronted with weak states which sit on large resources that are fueling essentially the global economy, I mean, if you look at some of these resources that are mined in various African countries, these are the building blocks to your fourth industrial revolution and some of the new technologies that we are seeing. So a combination of that, I think, basically feeds instability and hinders our fight to actually silence the gun.
We have come to the end of this program on priorities and vision of African development. We had Dr. Philani Ntembo, the Executive Director of the Pretoria-based Institute for Global Dialogue, a foreign policy think tank. Tune in again next week for another program of Spotlight Africa. And on behalf of the team, I'm Issa Khomu, your presenter and producer, bidding goodbye.